Good afternoon, and thanks very much for tuning in to KDVS 90.3 FM here in Davis this afternoon. This is Dr. Andy Jones, and I will be your host for this next hour of programming, that being Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. I've been living in a world of poetry, yay, this last week. Since I spoke to you last, I've been to 3 poetry readings, and by now I've become an addict. By that, I mean that you can really get quite a rush from attending a poetry reading, and from really enjoying the various personalities assembled. I'm going to give you a few examples over the course of this hour, but let's just say that in this past week, we've had Dana Gioia on campus this past Thursday. He's the Bush's pick for the head of the National Endowment for the Arts. Perhaps a year from now, when we watch Bush's State of the Union address, if we care to watch it at all, we might see Dana Gioia, the poet, sitting in the audience, standing from time to time, at times when even Hillary Clinton stood with a standing ovation during Bush's speech yesterday. We also enjoyed the poetry on this past Friday in the English department of Joshua Clover, who's a poet in the tradition of John Ashbery and a frequent contributor to the Village Voice. If you Google Joshua Clover, you'll see what I mean. And then this past Monday, it was Joe Wenderoth who was visiting. And Joe Wenderoth is a poet much more in the tradition of the confessional poets, Robert Lowell, Sylvia Plath, and John Berryman. So I thought that today, rather than starting with the theme music to this show, Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour, I thought we might start instead with a poem by John Berryman, this one called simply The Ball Poem.
The Ball Poem. What is the boy now who has lost his ball? What is he to do? I saw it go merrily bouncing down the street and then merrily over. There it is in the water. No use to say, oh, there are other balls. An ultimate shaking grief fixes the boy as he stands rigid, trembling, staring down all his young days into the harbor where his ball went. I would not intrude on him. A dime another ball is worthless. Now he senses first responsibility, passions. People will take balls. Balls will be lost always, little boy, and no one buys a ball back. Money is external. He is learning, well behind his desperate eyes, the epistemology of loss, how to stand up, knowing what every man must one day know, and most know many days, how to stand up, and gradually light returns to the street. A whistle blows, the ball is out of sight. Soon part of me will explore the deep and dark floor of the harbor. I am everywhere. I suffer and move, my mind and my heart move with all that move me, under the water or whistling. I am not a little boy. Thank you.
are listening this afternoon to Ray Charles, who does the theme music for Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour every Wednesday afternoon from 5 to 6. Thank you, Ray, for starting off today's show. I was talking before about poetry readings, and while we were hearing John Berryman read the Ball Poem, while we were hearing What I Say by Ray Charles, a real-life poet walked into the studio, and so let's talk to her. Jennifer Mason, welcome to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks very much for coming in today. So where, I saw you rush in just as the show was starting. Where are you coming from?
I was teaching a discussion section for Introduction to Film Studies.
Introduction to Film Studies. Now, do we have a film studies program or department on campus, or is that offered through another program?
This was offered through the humanities department, but I think they have just made a film major.
Excellent.
So.
And who's the instructor for the class?
Professor Vishnupriya Ghosh.
Mm-hmm. And so what film were you talking about before running down to 14 Lower Freeborn?
We were talking about Strictly Ballroom, actually.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then generally talking about all Hollywood movies. And
right. So that's a, if I remember correctly, that's a Baz Luhrmann film, is
it
that
is,
how you say
it? Yeah.
Who many of you know as the director of a more recent film with a good amount of dancing. And that being what I'm blanking on. It's my wife's favorite film.
Moulin Rouge.
That's right, Moulin Rouge. Okay. And so what are some of the other films that you're covering in Introduction to Film Studies this quarter?
Well, we started with Singing in the Rain, and then, Citizen Kane and Vertigo, and then we've done Strictly Ballroom.
Excellent.
And there's more to come.
And do you have a film background as well as a poetry background?
Not really. I'm very interested in French cinema at the turn of the century. But my background is mainly in talking about literature, and that's why I'm actually really interested to do this class, because I'm thinking about a different kind of text.
Excellent. The summer before last, I taught a film theory class where we also did Singing in the Rain. I guess because it's really one of the best musicals out there, and because it's a film about the movie industry that inevitably gets taught in film classes.
It's so self-conscious that it's easy to talk about the history of cinema, just beginning with that.
Yeah. Absolutely. And a new release of the film. I don't know if you're aware of this. It was showing in Chicago when I was there over the holiday break. But there's a new touched-up release of the film where the colors are even more vibrant and sparkling.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's the sort of thing that'll be arriving in Davis in about 2005. Well, Jennifer Mason is in the studio with me, and we're going to be talking about poetry. She'll also be reading her poetry this evening. But so that you folks at home can get a sense of Singing in the Rain, if you haven't seen the film recently, then let me now introduce you all to Gene Kelly and to Donald O'Connor in a scene from Singing in the Rain. We'll be right back on KDBS.
Sinful Caesar sipped his snifter, seized his knees and sneezed.
Marvelous.
Marvelous.
Oh, here is a good one. Chester chooses chestnuts, cheddar cheese with chewy chives. He chews them and he chooses them. He chooses them and he chews them. Those chestnuts, cheddar cheese and chives in cheery, charming chunks.
Oh, wonderful. But do another one.
Oh, thank you. Moses supposes his toes are roses, but Moses supposes erroneously. Moses, he knows his toes aren't roses, as Moses supposes his toes to be.
Moses supposes his toes are roses, but Moses supposes erroneously.
But Moses, he knows his toes aren't roses, as Moses supposes his toes to be.
Moses supposes his toes are roses, but Moses supposes erroneously.
A Moses is a Mose.
A rose is a rose.
A toes is a toes.
Hoop-de-doody-doodle.
Moses supposes his toes are roses, but Moses supposes erroneously. For Moses, he knows his toes aren't roses, as Moses supposes his toes to be.
Moses,
Moses,
This, of course, is Moses Supposes from Singing in the Rain, and those were the tap-dancing toes of Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor, as well as their voices that we heard in the background. I figure, how often can we bring together the world of poetry, in the form there of tongue twisters, and the world of musical theater than with, what better occasion to do that than with Moses Supposes from Singing in the Rain, the 1951 film, if I remember correctly. Okay, so back to the radio show. Oh, yes, Singing in the Rain. You know, it's a great DVD. If you're just starting your DVD collection, pick yourself up a copy of Singing in the Rain, especially if you have small children or if small children ever visit you, and just play them the musical numbers over and over again. Geneva and Jackson, my 5 and 2-year-old, had their friends Claire and Colin over for a play date weekend before last. And after dinner, I just put on the DVD, and the four kids just danced around the living room like lunatics and fell down laughing eventually. And it was so much fun that we got the camcorder out. I'm thinking, actually, when the fundraiser comes along, I think I'll be offering as a premium about 2 minutes of footage of Geneva and Jackson and their two friends dancing in my living room to anyone who wants to give a pledge of $50. So, you know, get out your checkbook now, write the check for $50, post-date it if you must for the first week of April, but be ready to send that in if you'd like that fancy premium. Well, back in the studio this afternoon, we have Jennifer Mason, and she is a poet. She's a graduate student in the English department in the MFA program. Remind me what where you are coming from, Jennifer. What brought you to UC Davis, and how did you get here?
Well, I grew up in Alabama, actually, mm-hmm. and then I went to George Washington University in D.C.,
mm-hmm.
And then I really was interested in coming out west, and of course Gary Snyder was teaching here, and
right.
he was a hero, you know, so.
Excellent, good for you. Now, in terms of George Washington University, were you pleased with the education you got there, and who did you get to work with in terms of poets or literature professors that folks might know?
I was pleased with it. My professor, actually, that I studied with several times is David McAlevey, and he hasn't published very much recently, but I think he should be.
Uh-huh.
He's got a lot of groundbreaking work. I think he just wrote something called Huge Haiku, where he started with one line that was haiku, and then did seven lines, and then ended up having to do 49, and it just got out of hand.
Oh, I see. So there's like a mathematical principle.
Right. Okay. But I also, they have a writer-in-residence program there, and Tony Hoagland was the writer when
mm-hmm.
I was studying there, so I got a chance to work with him, and that was great. He knew a lot of contemporary poets, they were his friends that he was working with, and so he brought a lot of new people into our reading lists that I really benefited from.
I noticed on the website for the Washington Post last week, and I checked this for my mom, who still lives in Washington, D.C., where I was born and raised, that there are a number of like high-profile authors who regularly come through D.C., who will read at Politics and Prose, the bookstore, and such that increasingly Washington, D.C., because of the political interest, has become a media center. And therefore, when poets, writers of all sorts go on book tours, they necessarily go through D.C. So there's a lot more going on there in terms of the literary world than one might expect when one's thinking of places to go to school as an undergraduate or a graduate student.
You know, that's absolutely true. And even though the actual writing scene was sometimes difficult to find, though it did exist, we really were fortunate to be able to see all these writers that passed through the Folger Shakespeare Library as well. Got to see a lot of great writers that just had to pass through because it was Washington.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, we talked about Gary Snyder before, and if you all are wondering if Gary Snyder could explain in 18 seconds how it is that poetry comes to him, then certainly you all should listen to this.
How poetry comes to me. It comes blundering over the boulders at night. It stays frightened outside the range of my campfire. I go to meet it at the edge of the light.
So did you have a chance to work with Gary Snyder before he retired this past year?
I did. I actually got to work in his very last workshop here. So that was last spring. Yeah.
Excellent. And in terms of your expectations, what you hoped to learn, the sort of hero worship that had been a part of your understanding of his poetry previously, what tell us a little bit about that experience of taking that workshop with him.
Well, you know, it was really more of an experience of listening to him talk about poetry and about life in general and having discussions about that than breaking down our poems, which, you know, we wrote plenty, but we were thinking about it more more in terms of how it fit in with our lives and what we really believed about language. And
so it might be that many of the benefits of that particular workshop will be realized in years to come.
Certainly.
As you make additional discoveries. So that's where you spent some time in Washington, D.C. at GW, came out to UC Davis, and what you talked a little bit about Gary Snyder. Who are some of the other poets that you've worked with, and how would you describe some of the poetic discoveries that you've made, either about your own work or about others' people's work since you got here?
Well, you know, my father is a composer, and my mother is in visual art. So I've always had this kind of, you know, angel and the devil, or not so much in those terms, but this conflicting opinion about what's important in your relationship to the reader, and how wide of leaps can you make in your poetry. And my father does a lot of electronic music, you know, breaking up the idea of melody what we think of as dissonance is not necessarily dissonant, and all those sorts of things. And I've spent a lot of my childhood actually thinking about how you could do that in language. And actually, when I worked with Tony Hoagland, he's very, very big on the audience and how you can talk to regular people. Mm-hmm. And so I pretty much got away from thinking about that for a long time. You know, I really wanted to find a way to connect with my audience. And now that since I've been here, I've found a way to sort of a middle ground where you can still be expressive,
right,
and expect people to respond to you, but not necessarily give them exactly what they want every time.
Interesting. Now, let's remind people where you'll be at 7 o'clock tonight. You talked about connecting with your audience. Your audience will have a chance to connect with you as you perform some of your poetry. What's that event this evening?
It's the graduate creative writing students that put on this reading every Wednesday night, actually, at Cafe Roma on 3rd Street, right next to campus. It starts at 7 o'clock. There'll be three readers tonight. Mandy Dawn, a fiction writer. Eve Imagine, a fiction writer, and me, the poet, your little dose of non-narrative structure. And, it's really fun. A lot of people come out, and it's a good evening.
Excellent. Do you feel that poets are generally outnumbered in the program, that you have to stand up for yourself? Do you feel that there's enough focus on poetry?
Well, we're definitely outnumbered, at least 2-1. In fact, there's only 6 poets currently in the department. But, we hold our ground. We make a lot of noise.
Now, 6 poets, is that 6 poets? Can that be 6 graduate student poets total?
Oh, actually, there's 7. I'm sorry, there's 7 poets total.
So in terms of, it's a 2-year program. Mm-hmm. So in terms of poets who came in last year, poets who came in this year, there are merely 7 of you.
Right.
That's shocking. but I guess that what the department has to do, the MFA program, is choose the best available authors, split between poetry and fiction writers. And therefore, if we have to be more choosy when it comes to our poets, then all the better. It'll certainly strengthen the program.
And we get more attention there.
Absolutely. Good. Well, I bet you've been to a couple of the Cafe Roma readings, Wednesday evening readings so far. Can you give us a sense of what those are like, what sort of audiences show up? You know, what the lighting is like, what sort of discoveries are made there?
Well, actually, I'm after a manner of speaking, in charge of organizing the whole thing, so
okay.
I have a lot to say about that. But it's a good venue because it is so close to campus, and there's a lot of space, and actually a nice little stage.
Mm-hmm.
We're not able to move the lighting around so that the stage is lit, but we are able to dim the audience lights, so we try and create a nice balance. And if nobody orders espresso, then we have a good silence.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there's a little interruption. But it's actually a nice venue because there's enough space for a lot of people to pack in. And actually, the last 2 weeks, we've been absolutely stuffed, standing room only. It's really exciting. I hope it continues that way the rest of the quarter.
That's great. I hope so as well. Did you attend Monday's Joe Wenderoth reading?
I did.
Can you give us a sense, both in terms of a summary and your own impression, of how Joe Wenderoth uses lighting in his readings and your impression of it?
Well, we had a chance to talk to Joe Wenderoth beforehand, the graduate students, and he mentioned that he was influenced by this idea that E. Cummings had stood up when he gave a reading and had everything dark except for the work, so there was just a lamp on the work. And I think he was working off that, because what Joe did was he had all the lights off in the room, and he actually put foil over the windows to make it as dark as he could, and then he sat down behind the podium. So I could sort of see part of him. I think other people could see different parts, but I think there were definitely some people who couldn't see him at all. And he read...
And he was mic'd.
He was mic'd, yeah.
Right.
With a portable mic, so he wasn't holding anything.
Right.
And he read a very long piece that seemed to have separate sections divided by a blues or a country song that he would sing out, just a stanza or two, and then go on. And then he actually made a separation between that kind of reading and what he did in his book Letters to Wendy's, because he had the lights come on and he stood up and he came up to the podium and read those in a different kind of way.
So it was almost as if he reassumed the persona of the poet
exactly.
Or of the speaker to present his letters to Wendy's. And for those of you who aren't familiar with that book, it's difficult to say whether it's a book of poetry or if it's epistolary fiction or what it is. But in this book, Wenderoth takes on this persona of a very odd person who is responding in those comment cards that evidently you find in some fast food restaurants where they ask you for your opinions. And so a number of poems that are just long enough to A, fit in the comment card, and B, to show that the speaker is very, very strange. And it reminded me a little bit almost of the sort of short poems, though often not quite this short, the short poems that William Carlos Williams would write on the prescription blanks that I almost imagine, you know, is between patients. And he always had that pad there. And so he'd write
something. Oh, that's a great comparison.
About plums in the refrigerator or a red wheelbarrow or whatever the case may be, and that we get a sense of that poem in part because of what it came out of. And so Joe Wenderoth gave us a sense of that as well with these letters to Wendy. Okay, well, why don't we hear a quick public service announcement from our friends at the Linux Users Group of Davis. And although this is only 45 seconds long, during those seconds I will try to find you all a poem by William Carlos Williams so you can get a sense of his voice. You're listening to KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis, and this is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
The Linux Users Group of Davis, or LUGOD, is a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting the Linux computer operating system and other open source products as an alternative to expensive, proprietary, and monopolistic software. LUGOD meets in Davis on the first Tuesday and third Monday of each month. For more information, visit LUGOD's website at lugod.org or contact Bill Kendrick at 530-759-1019. Or via email at root@lugod.org.
Speaking of Bill Kendrick, I just got an email from Bill this morning. He tells me that Don Marti, editor-in-chief of Linux Journal magazine, will be coming to LUGOD next Tuesday, February 4th, to talk about the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And those of us in radio are very concerned about the DMCA because of, especially with a small station like this, and the fact that we stream our music, our public affairs programming, our astrology programs, we stream that all onto the Internet. And there was a time when small stations like KDVS would either have to give up that right to stream to whomever might want to listen to us on the Internet, say via kdvs.org, pay huge, huge bills. And I think that was largely worked out, but still those of us in community radio continue to be concerned about the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Perhaps you are concerned as well. If you are, then visit, won't you, www.lugod.org. to find out more about this event next Tuesday, February 4th, and I think that'll happen at the Davis Public Library on 14th Street. Well, I promised you before some William Carlos Williams. Here is a poem of his called Queen Anne's Lace.
Queen Anne's Lace. Her body is not so white as anemone petals, nor so smooth, nor so remote a thing. It is a field of the wild carrot taking the field by force. The grass does not raise above it. Here is no question of whiteness, white as can be, with a purple mole at the center of each flower. Each flower is a hand's span of her whiteness. Wherever her hand has lain, there is a tiny purple blemish. Each part is a blossom under his touch, to which the fibers of her being stem one by one, each to its end. Until the whole field is a white desire, empty, a single stem, a cluster, flower by flower, a pious wish to whiteness gone over, or nothing.
This is Dr. Andy back on the air. Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour is the name of the show on KDVS, your community radio station. And in the studio this afternoon, I have Jennifer Mason. She is a poet, a former Washingtonian for a short time, as I mentioned on the website for this program, which is www.culturelover.com, and also, as I mentioned on that website, a Francophone. And so I basically threatened Jennifer and told her that if she wants to come on the show, I might ask her to read something in French. And I was half joking, but lo and behold, she's brought an anthology with her. It's got some French poems. So, Jennifer, you're going to share something with us. Which poem did you choose to read in French to our audience?
Well, I was looking through, and I wanted to find something rather short. So, this is by an author called Jules Supervieille, which is rather funny because his last name just means Jules, really old.
Uh-huh.
So the poem is called Pont Supérieur.
Superior thoughts? Or
Superior, the higher bridge, or the plank of a ship, actually.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay, good. Let's hear it.
Pont Supérieur. Plante verte sur le pont. Plante qui change d'étoile et va d'escale en escale, goûtant à chaque horizon. Plante, branche et ramille, l'hélice tu fais trembler et ma main qui te dessine tremble d'être sur la mer. Mais je découvre la terre prise dans ton pot carré, celle-là que je cherchais dans le fond de ma jumelle.
Have you had a chance to study French poetry in a class or did you live abroad? How did you approach how do you approach the French language and French poetry?
Well, I was a French major in college, mm-hmm. but that was actually after I spent my junior year abroad in Paris, and I got to study French literature there. So that was a lot of fun. I didn't really know anything about French literature before going, so it was a crash course in
right.
an entire body of literature. But really, that's one of the funner ways to do it.
Oh, definitely. Do you think that you might find yourself or that you feel qualified to teach some French literature at some point or maybe read poems in translation or explore some of that with students?
I think I would like to explore that with French students. Mm-hmm. I'm not qualified to teach French from a grammar perspective or linguistic perspective, but I would like to talk about the literature. I'm actually more interested in French prose.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out American poetry and French prose are really my favorites.
Uh-huh.
So,
interesting. Now, so you'll be reading at Cafe Roma in an hour and a half with two other students from the graduate MFA program here at UC Davis. Can you give us a sense of the sort of poems that you're planning on presenting to us and what sort of influences or echoes we might hear in your work?
Well, it turns out that I've been writing a lot of poems about works of art lately, which mm-hmm. It's not something I ever expected to do, but this year it's been happening. So I've pulled a lot of those new ones out, and I'll be reading those. And actually, most of them are from works of art that were important to me when I was living in France, because, of course, I had no friends, and I didn't really know anybody. It was raining all the time, so I spent a lot of time in museums. And that's really the emotional connection that I had was with works of art. So
interesting. Now, did you see Joshua Clover read on Friday?
I did.
He made an offhanded comment about, I think they're called, is it
Ekphrasis, yeah.
Ekphrasis, which are poems about like other media of art, and not necessarily visual art, but it could be about dance or sculpture or what have you. And he often said that those aren't his favorite kinds of poems. Do you remember what his reasoning was for that? And was it your question that prompted that response?
It wasn't my question, but I think it was partly about me.
Uh-huh.
He talked about how I think he didn't really like the idea in general of a poem being about anything in particular.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, many of our listeners at home who might not be as close readers of poetry or as frequent readers of poetry as you and I would be, might wonder, if a poem's not about something, then what is its function? What is it doing? What's it doing on the page if it's not about something?
Well, you know, it's just like when you see a non-objective painting.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who look for, you know, can try and connect the dots and see some kind of object in there, but it's not very useful because it's not the subject of the painting is not to portray something realistic that
right.
you would see. So I think that there's a good analogy in poetry. I think Joshua Clover is getting at something really interesting there.
Good.
Yeah.
So we might see the influence of John Ashbery and Joshua Clover's work. Who might we see in your poetry if we come to see you at Cafe Roma tonight at 7?
Well, actually, I am influenced by John Ashbery in many ways. There's one poem that I've really been working on recently that comes out of a book by Ann Carson called The Autobiography of Red.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a retelling of a Greek myth. And the characters become real characters. It's a verse novel. And I've been dealing with the myth of Leda and the Swan for quite a long time, several years, and trying to figure out what to do with that. And this book actually gave me some good ideas. So I'm going to be premiering that tonight.
Oh, interesting. Good for you. Well, speaking of premiering something for us, do you have something of your own that you'd be willing to share with our listeners this evening? And while you rustle some papers, let me remind you all that you're listening to KDBS 90.3 FM, that I have Jennifer Mason here in the studio. We're talking about poetry, other people's poetry, her poetry, and the fact that she'll be sharing her poetry live this evening at 7 p.m. at the Cafe Roma on 3rd Street, just a block from the UC Davis campus. Do you know the order of reading? What if you're due to read first, second, or third?
I will most likely be second, but I might be third. I'm waiting for some friends coming in from San Francisco battling traffic. So.
I see. Okay, good. Well, Jennifer Mason, what poem are you going to share with us first this evening?
Well, since we were just talking about France and trying to sort of make sense of things there in the rain,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to read my, obligatory Paris poem as a poet.
Excellent.
And it's called In Paris, I Become a Sheet. In Paris, I become a sheet of tracing paper. Only light and the darkest marks come through. Gray blots out more than thought. It muffles skies and disguises voices. It is a thin time. I learn to make sense of things with what colors left. Black Paris, my landlady's cat. Brown Paris, the bus for downtown, line 85. Red Paris, Défense d'entrée. Black Paris, a spit roasting chickens. Brown Paris, coffee spilled in a saucer. Red Paris, sidewalks in Saint-Ouen. My blue is a tea bowl. A color called cold is October. Columns in a cathedral, moss on the quay, my throat for a week. A bathtub dragged down the street makes a shrill color like ammonia poured on the carpet. In museums, the burnt orange that makes me want to cry. Gauguin's skinny dog, the left wing of Van Gogh's bat. Bluish bird shit on the sleeve of my burgundy coat. White-barked sycamores in the square, dashing their brass hands against the asphalt. Morning, shutters opening to a man with a yellow umbrella. After Christmas, my landlady fills her courtyard with abandoned trees that are still green. The smell stings. It is so alive.
It's really interesting what you do with color in that poem. It reminded me a little bit of some Wallace Stevens poems and what he does with color. There's a poem of his, actually, that also involves sheets. Do you remember which one I'm talking about? There's like a haunting, and there are ghosts, and there are different colors. Often I bring my anthology with me in the studio. I neglected to do so.
Yeah, the one where there's tigers and... Yeah, there's tigers in the end.
if you know what poem we're talking about, feel free to phone us here at the studio at 752-2777 in the 530 area code. You could have a chance to read this Wallace Stevens poem on the air on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Well, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll come back. Here's some more poetry of Jennifer Mason. First, this isn't quite Parisian, but this might remind some of you of Berlin. Here is the theme from The Third Man. Thank you. We're back on the air. That was the theme from The Third Man. And it's really one of my favorite tunes that involves the zither. Well, there was an article in the Davis Enterprise a couple days ago. You might have seen it. This was on Monday, January 27th. And it was titled, Math Gets a Dance Touch. It begins, dancing and math? They're not only related, but Carl Schaefer and Eric Stern are adept at showing that it's hard to do one without the other. Their performance of Two Guys Dancing About Math, which has delighted audiences across the United States for more than 10 years, will be presented at 6 p.m. Friday, February 7th, in the UC Davis Mondavi Center's Rumsey Rancheria Grand Lobby. Admission is free, and the program is open to all. I find myself very lucky to have one of those two performers, Professor Eric Stern, professor of dance at Weber State University in Utah. Professor Stern, welcome to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
Thank you, Dr. Andy. Is that what I should call you?
You can call me that. Sometimes people call me that ironically. People also call me Andy.
I see.
I answer to all of these.
Okay.
But I wanted to start with the question that I often get when I tell people about Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. They wonder, you know, what could the connection be? So I'll just ask you right from the start, what could the connection be between dance and mathematics?
Well, the short answer would be pattern. Mathematics,
okay.
Mathematics concerns itself with patterns and understanding them and manipulating them and making symbols about them. And dance is profoundly interested in pattern, both in time and in space. And sometimes the patterns are very mathematical in a formal sense, and sometimes pattern on an abstract way. Another way in which dance and math are connected is they begin with very palpable things, concrete things. How many, or where do you put your foot, or what shape. But they both quickly, we have found, kind of go to the abstract. And sometimes that's what frustrates people about them. I know people who are math phobic often.
Mm-hmm.
The symbology puts them off. And the same about the arts at times. People who aren't conversant in the arts get put off by the abstract nature of them. I should say, though, that the show that we do is very accessible. There are a range of kind of movements or kind of movement styles or movement I should say, movements that we draw from. There's a dance with basketball where we talk about physics of motion and other motions as well.
So I bet that in terms of educating the public that you've presented a version of this presentation to all sorts of school-age audiences.
We've performed them from kindergarten up through graduate school students, and the dance audiences. We've performed it at, we've gone to dozens of conferences that are either education conferences or mathematics conferences or dance conferences, like national math conferences. We've also gone to like a conference called International Dance and the Child, which every 3 years is in a different part of the world. So, yeah, we've played to a lot of different types of people.
Now, from doing a little bit of reading on the Internet, I assume that you and Dr. Carl Schaefer are not in the same city or even in the same state. Isn't that right?
Yeah, we began in Santa Cruz together, Santa Cruz, California, where Carl still lives.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a company of actually five loose-knit people, although the show that we're going to be doing, which is also the show we're going to be touring a lot in the spring, is it the two-man show. And so we started having a company together, and then I got a job to help me. You know, I have a wife, and at that time one child, and now we have two children. And so, you know, I needed to have a more stable income as well. So I kind of do burn the candle at both ends, have a dance company and teach dance at the university.
Definitely. Good for you. Now, and this will be something that will be interesting to many of our listeners here at UC Davis, where we graduate more biology majors than any other university in the nation, and that is that you graduated from college with a degree in biology.
I did. I don't know if this is going to go the direction you want it to go, but I did graduate with a degree in biology, and I was interested in biology.
Many of my students say, I wonder what I'm going to do with this. Do I have to become a doctor? Do I have to become a research scientist?
Right.
And you became a dancer who interprets the patterns of mathematics.
Well, and also, I mean, also, there's a real theatrical element to the show, and it's funny, and there's a lot of audience interaction. And so there's even parts that I would say are somewhat vaudevillian. But I'm sorry, I just wanted to clarify that about the show. But, you know, how do I reconcile that I got a degree in biology and then promptly started working as a dance accompanist?
Well, you needn't reconcile it at all, but it's certainly an interesting story.
But the thing I was going to say was that... what I tell people is usually people get their first degree in something that they're good at. You have to study what you're good at. Well, I actually picked something that wasn't my strong suit to get a degree in. I don't know if that's admirable or stupid, but it's what I did.
Well, it's certainly very interesting, and we'll all be interested in your presentation, your performance with Dr. Carl Schaefer. And let me remind folks at home that I'm chatting with Professor Eric Stern, a dance professor at Weber State University, and he and his colleague Carl Schaefer will be presenting a performance this coming Friday called Two Guys Dancing About Math. And it is being presented 6 p.m. this coming Let's see, I'm saying this coming, but it's actually Friday, February 7th, so it's a week from Friday at the UC Davis Mondavi Center's Rumsey Rancheria Grand Lobby. Admission is free, and if you want to find out more about that, you can go to the website for this radio show, which is culturelover.com, or you can go to mondavi.org to find out about what else is being presented at the Mondavi Center for the Arts. Well, Professor Eric Stern, I'd like to thank you very much for taking some time to chat with us today about Two Guys Dancing About Math.
It's my pleasure, and The Third Man is one of my favorite movies.
Well, I'm glad that we were able to use that to introduce you to our listeners.
Okay.
Have a good evening, sir.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is Dr. Andy of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. We are going to be back just in about 30 seconds to hear from Eve Imagine, who is also reading this evening at Cafe Roma on 3rd Street at 7 p.m. But first, let's hear a poem by Edna St. Vincent Millay called Recuerdo.
We were very tired. We were very merry. We were very tired. We were very merry. We had gone back and forth all night on the ferry. It was bare and bright and smelled like a stable. But we looked into a fire. We leaned across a table. We lay on a hilltop underneath the moon. And the whistles kept blowing and the dawn came soon. We were very tired. We were very merry. We had gone back and forth all night on the ferry. And you ate an apple, and I ate a pear. From a dozen of each we had bought somewhere. And the sky went warm, and the wind came cold, and the sun rose dripping, a bucket full of gold. We were very tired. We were very merry. We had gone back and forth all night on the ferry. We hailed, "Good morrow, mother," to a shawl-covered head and bought a morning paper which neither of us read. And she wept, "God bless you," for the apples and pears. And we gave her all our money but our subway fares.
I'm proud to say that today's KDBS Public Affairs show, Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour, is proudly sponsored by the Lorenzo Patino School of Law and Paralegal at the University of Northern California. Lorenzo Patino Law School is located in downtown Sacramento. The evening school offers a 4-year state bar-approved Juris Doctor degree and a 1-year state-approved paralegal legal assistant certificate to students interested in working in the public interest. Lorenzo Patino Law School also provides students with the opportunity to gain real-life experience in the law through coursework that provides free legal services to those unable to pay for them. For more information about enrollment, please call 916-441-4000. 4485 or on the web at www.patinolawschool.com. And let me also just mention that I very much appreciate the Lorenzo Patina School sponsoring this program. I'd also like to tell you all that the Lincoln Training Center is opening a new office in Roseville. The center will help people with disabilities secure employment and aid employers in training people with disabilities. For more information, contact Deborah Brighton at 916-788-7280. Well, as promised, this afternoon in the studio, I have been recently joined by Eve Imagine, a poet, journalist, and fiction writer, whose work you'll also be able to enjoy this evening at Cafe Roma at 7 o'clock. Eve, welcome to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you here. Now, tell us a little bit about what you're going to be reading this evening at Cafe Roma.
Tonight, I'm reading a brand new story, which is exciting for me. Last week at this time, I was writing it. So tomorrow it gets workshopped, in fact. So I'm excited because it's still fresh.
So it's an exercise in bravery to a certain extent that you're presenting it even before it's gone through the peer review of your discerning friends in workshop.
That's right. I figure this is its last chance to be, you know, itself before it gets goes through that revision process. And
excellent.
Yeah.
So if you all want to hear some, I guess, what we could call raw fiction, then you could come by Cafe Roma this evening at 7. And before I ask you to read a poem, Eve, tell us a little bit about you are a commuter. We were just talking about Sacramento. You're a commuter from Sacramento, and you've been active in the kind of artsy music, poetry, performance world of Sacramento. Can you give us just a little bit of a taste of the sort of things that you've been interested in and what you've done?
Sure. I am really interested in the Midtown scene in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of new artists and people that are active, you know, trying to make a community happen around Midtown, Joe's Style Shop, Capitol Garage, just different places, bands, you know, including music and visual, whatever, all kinds of art, performance art. So just making that happen, keeping it alive. Not a lot of poetry readings, but maybe in the future.
Mm-hmm. Good, good for you. Yeah. The fate of Joe's Style Shop was a topic of the program on the air at this hour, KDBS yesterday, where the Panic Attack show, which is a law show, basically was looking at the constitutionality of what has befallen Joe's Style Shop in the last couple weeks. If you want to find out more about that, you could probably Google Joe's Style Shop, or you can email me and I will connect you with some of the relevant links. There was also an article about the establishment in the Sacramento News and Review a couple weeks ago, so one could find that in the archive of the Sacramento News and Review website. Well, Eve Imagine, what are you going to present to us this afternoon over the radio?
Well, I write poetry for fun as a
as we all do.
Exercise in stress relief. And I have a poem, a villanelle, called Praying Hands of the Fathers.
Okay, great. Let's hear it.
Okay. Along the path lined with daisies, petal upon petal, pointing out misinterpreted opportunities, she fills her woven basket with blackberries. Her hands are mottled red, bloody. Her children will eat tonight from creation's pie. She rustles by and then she leaves. She sees me. A liberated look from her thrusts me down to my unhinged knees. I cannot look up. I panic and wheeze. Breaths tease. I'm too shy. On the pungent ground next to sun-warped morning glories, I fade into my imaginaries. Ill at ease, they drink in my stories, but not one believes in my allegories. Too many similes, my vagaries. These hoarfrost faculties say I lie. I'd rather die. She rustles by, and then she leaves. Again, I tell them, he touches me, and at his broad-footed base, I beg him, no, please. But he disagrees, and I must remain naked on the wet mushroom muck to freeze, my skin cracked and dry. On the pungent ground, next to sun-warped morning glories, I fade into my imaginaries. I refuse those philosophies upon which the diocese agrees. They tell summaries of the human disease. Though frailties and fears and hypocrisies and thousands of tears I cry, on the pungent ground next to sun-warped morning glories, I fade into my imaginaries. She wrestles by, and then she leaves.
I really love the way that you are able to intertwine the rhymes, the internal rhymes, the end rhymes that I hear. And as is often the case with a villanelle, we've got interesting stanzaic repetitions. Do you find that when you're writing your fiction that you ever feel compelled as well to kind of have the language come alive as it did in that poem?
Very much.
Mm-hmm.
In the story that I wrote for tonight, I think it's just one of those things where I have to trust it and go with it, because sometimes I'm not sure if it's going to come through the way